This podcast is designed to help you understand the laws of our land. I am your host, Hattie Savari, and here to help you every step of the way, whether you are a tenant, landlord, parent, child, employee, employer, neighbour or business owner, and we are all most certainly consumers. The law is in your life every single day with over 180 episodes and 5 million downloads. Get ready to listen and empower yourself with tons of jargon-free legal information in plain and simple English. Today's episode is supported by Red Bar Law, the go-to law firm for expert, efficient and fast legal assistance, all at a fixed cost. Go to our website at redbarlaw.com. Hello and welcome back to our podcast at Get Legally Speaking. Our legal conversation today will be about disputing a will contested probate. I am joined by barrister Stephanie Cummings from 23 Essex Street Chambers based in London and Manchester. Stephanie is highly regarded by both her lay and professional clients, and she has a particular experience in contested probate, Inheritance Act claims, claims by and against executors, administrators and trustees. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me and for that lovely introduction as well.
Thank you, absolutely. And I'm super enthusiastic this time because I'm going to tell our listeners we had a huge technical glitch. So we literally started recording and then it all went wrong and I had a meltdown. But I'm over that meltdown now and we're here to discuss disputing a will. Right, let's talk about what's going on in this area of the world. According to one of the world's largest independent financial advisory organisations, De Vere Group, will inquiries have increased by 76% since the start of the coronavirus outbreak in the UK, unsurprisingly. And the Law Society Gazette reported that the average age of people making a will in the UK is now 58 years old. And I was saying earlier, wasn't I, Stephanie, I think that's quite old in the sense that I made my will when I had my first child, because I felt really responsible all of a sudden in life, as you should, I guess. So let's talk about this. Let's tell our listeners, what is meant by probate, Stephanie?
So in England and Wales, the word probate is normally used to describe the legal and financial processes involved in dealing with the assets of the person who has died, so their property, money and possessions. Before the next of kin or executor named in the will can deal with the assets, they may need to apply for probate. And when probate has been granted, the next of kin or executor can then start to deal with the deceased person's assets, either in accordance with the will, or if there hasn't been a will, the law determines who receives the assets.
So getting a grant of probate means you have got permission in law to execute the wishes of the will.
Yes, that's right.
Perfect. Okay. And so let's talk about what's meant by contested probate, the term. I think we've all heard it. I started hearing it a few years ago in life, but what is meant by that?
Yeah, so when we talk about contested or sometimes we talk about contentious probate, those are terms that we use to refer to a dispute involving inheritance or the validity of a will. So essentially, it's a disagreement after someone has passed away about how to distribute their estate. And that dispute could emerge from a feeling that you weren't left what you felt you were deserved or you were promised, or concerns regarding the way in which the will was made. So broadly, there's two main areas of dispute. Firstly, disputing the validity of a will because, for example, you might think the deceased was coerced into making a will contrary to their actual wishes. Or secondly, claiming you've not been properly provided for in the will or by the rules of intestacy. And those are called Inheritance Act claims.
Yes, I mean, yourmoney.com reported that contested wills, so disputed wills, reached an all-time high in 2019, and that was before the coronavirus hit the UK, and they're saying that the coronavirus could more than likely cause the number to rise further. So this is a question, I think, that people start asking themselves in their later years, and I maybe haven't got there just yet, although I'm in my later years. Do you have to leave your assets to your family members in your will?
So the short answer is no. So there's a fundamental principle of English law that people should, in general, be free to leave their property as they choose. However, that is subject to the right of certain classes of people to claim that they ought to be provided for under the Inheritance Act. So whilst you can choose not to leave assets to family members, in reality, a family member who fits certain criteria might have a successful claim against your estate.
Yes, and there's a term called disinherit, isn't there? So in theory, you could disinherit your adult children from your will. Yes. However, the Inheritance Act allows children of the deceased to make a claim against the estate if they can prove that the deceased, also referred to as a testator, failed to leave them reasonable financial provision. And I think we could do a podcast just on that term and what it means and how it's dissected. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about how you can try and protect your will from being contested. What steps could somebody take to think, to say, look, I'm putting this will together. I don't want arguments and fights and legal action over it after I've gone. What are the key steps people could consider taking to try and strengthen the validity of their will?
Yeah, so one thing you can do is by setting out your explanation of why it is you're leaving your assets in the way that you're leaving them. So if you are disinheriting someone, you'd set out why that was. Another option might be a no contest clause. But of course, if your will is found to be invalid, then that clause also will be invalid. So it might not be effective anyway.
So basically, explain your decision. If you are leaving out a member of your family, a child of yours or your wife even, I mean, I've heard of cases in the past through my law firm where spouses have left a man, this was one particular case, left his wife out of the will. Explain your decision. And the no contest clause that you mentioned, that I think that's very important. But again, you say if your will isn't valid for whatever reason, then that falls to the wayside. And proving your competency when you're signing your will. I mean, how could somebody do that? There's been sort of mention of recording, video recording your will signing and things like that. I mean, how far can you go? But how can you prove your competency when you're signing your will and putting it together?
So it is a difficult one. It obviously doesn't arise in every situation. The specific situations where people are having to prove their competency, and that might be because they're suffering with some sort of illness that affects competency, or even sort of just in the later years of their life, perhaps. So it won't affect everybody, but in those cases where you think your will might be affected by that, you can take steps to make sure that competency is less likely to be disputed. As you've said, video recording, instead of doing an at-home will, you might consider actually going to a solicitor's office. You might consider having an appointment with your GP, perhaps. So there's little steps that people can take in order to sort of shore things up and make their will more ironclad, if I can put it that way.
Yes, no, indeed. And there is a term called removing the appearance of undue influence. And I think, again, you think, well, how do you do that? How do you prove that your will has been written without you being under any undue influence? And because everybody's situation is so unique to them, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's a really tough one as well, because obviously any step that you take to show that your will wasn't written because of undue influence, you know, somebody seeking to dispute that will might say, well, you were actually pressured in order to take those steps, or you were pressured to write,
or coerced into making those decisions, and you know, brainwashed, and or you know, at worst you were bribed, or you know, things like that. You know, it can go on and on. You know, very unique to each family situation. It is interesting because I think in most people's minds, when you put your will together, that's it. I certainly thought that for many years. I thought the will is a will. Whatever it says, that's it. And so when I started to become aware of disputing a will, that wills could be disputed, some were being called out as invalid and the reasons, it's really an eye-opener, because you would never think it. You'd never think normally going about your business, you don't even think about doing a will, because you kind of relate it to being old and in your last leg of your life, your twilight years, whatever. But you know, when I decided, right, I need to get my will done, I was really upset, because I was thinking, oh my god, I'm talking about my death, and I'm in my sort of late 20s. But it is really important to think about, and I think getting a professional to write your will is definitely worth it. I have to say,
definitely. definitely.
Because then that leaves less room for anyone to come along and say, oh, it was done at home, it was an internet jobby, you know, it wasn't done in an environment where proper advice was taken, and legal advice, or that family member who has so much influence over that parent was there and, you know, nagging them in their ear or influencing them. So I think it's definitely worth getting your will done by a professional will writer or at a solicitor's firm, if that's what you choose. So let's talk about assets of a deceased person. What happens to assets if a person has not made a will? And how can a family member who's, you know, not got a will for the deceased person make a claim for the assets?
So if the deceased has died without making a will, what lawyers call having died intestate, then the deceased's estate or assets are dealt with according to the intestacy rules. Who inherits then depends on things like whether the deceased was married at the date of his or her death, and whether there's any children, and who the surviving members of the deceased family are. So essentially, there's a list of priorities, and the first priority is the husband, wife, or civil partner. Next on the list are children, or where children are deceased, grandchildren or great-grandchildren. Then comes parents, then siblings, then half-siblings, grandparents, uncles or aunts, and then lastly, if none of those family members survive you, your estate would pass to the Crown. It's slightly more complex if there's a surviving husband, wife or civil partner and surviving children if your estate is worth more than £270,000, because essentially the surviving husband, wife or civil partner is entitled to all of the first £270,000, and then the remainder is split essentially. So ultimately, if you're highest up the list, you can make that application for what's called letters of administration, and then you can administer the estate from there and deal with it.
So we're talking about if you don't have a will in place, or your partner didn't have a will in place, the wife, husband or cohabitee, in terms of if there's a civil partnership there.
Yeah,
cohabitee and civil partner, two separate things, absolutely. We'll get the first 270,000, and then the balance is split 50% to the civil partner or husband or wife, and then down to the children, and then down the food chain list of people that you mentioned.
So if there are children, it would just be split between the children. You wouldn't then move on unless...
So it doesn't go to grandchildren. Parents. It doesn't sort of say, right, there's three children, five grandchildren, that's eight people, we'll have to split it all there. It just stops, the division stops at the children if there isn't a will.
Yeah, that's right. If one of the children has passed, then their share will pass to the grandchildren.
And I think it's important to say that if you die without a will and your property and assets are jointly owned, then your spouse will automatically get those assets. But if you've died without a will and they're not jointly owned, that's when we're saying the 270,000 provision is made, the first 270,000. Anything left over, 50% to you, 50% to the children.
Yeah,
if there
right.
are children.
Yeah,
right.
So any property of which you're joint tenants, that automatically passes. Same with joint bank accounts.
Yes.
But those don't end up in the estate at all.
Yes, so anything jointly owned, even if there isn't a will, automatically comes to you. I mean, I can just see it, can't you? There's no will, and the wife or the husband, the remaining partner, only gets the first 270 and has to split the rest with the children. Imagine you've got a strained relationship with your children, and you think, well, you know. So I think there's an interesting message here, which is make sure everything is jointly owned, or have a will in place.
A lot of people don't actually know if their property, for example, their family home, a lot of people don't, you know, they might not remember whether they decided to own that jointly or they decided to own it as tenants in common. So it's really important to think about if you are buying a property as well. Those are important considerations.
Absolutely. And other assets, like you said as well, Stephanie, you know, the bank accounts or anything. It could be bonds. It could be shares. You know, if everything is jointly owned and there's no will, then the surviving partner gets it all. You don't need to sit there and divvy it up with the children in any shape or form. But if you don't have the will and it's not jointly owned, that's when, yes, the children do get a direct look in there. So let's talk about who can dispute a will on grounds that they were not in the will and then they've not been provided for. We mentioned the term reasonable financial provision earlier, didn't we, Stephanie? And I said we can just have a podcast just on that, I'm sure, and discuss lots of cases that I'm sure you've seen under those grounds. So Tell us about that, please.
So if you think you've not been provided for properly by the terms of a will or under the intestacy rules, you might be able to make a claim under the Inheritance Act. And there's certain categories of people who can make a claim. Essentially, the claim is that you haven't had reasonable financial provision. And what you're asking for is for the court to make reasonable financial provision for you. So the categories of people who can make a claim are civil partners or the spouse of the deceased, former civil partners or spouse of the deceased who hasn't remarried or entered into another civil partnership, children, and that includes adult children, any person who, in relation to a marriage or civil partnership in which the deceased was at the time a party.
So a cohabitee. So if you've just cohabiting.
Yeah, so this particular section, it's quite a wordy section, but what it means is that if the deceased has been acting in the role of a parent to children by way of a marriage or civil partnership or otherwise in relation to a family in which they stood at the time as a parent, then you can treat those children as a child of the family. So usually that's stepchildren in short, but it can go beyond stepchildren. Cohabitees, as you said, as long as you were living as husband or wife or as a civil partner for 2 years ending immediately on the deceased death.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? Because if you're not married and you're living with your partner, that's fine, as long as you've been living together for at least 2 years before your partner died.
Yeah, immediately before they die. So essentially, if there was for example, you've been living together for 2 years and you had a break of a certain period of time, you wouldn't fall into the cohabitee definition necessarily, but you might fall into the last category, which is essentially a catch-all, which is any person who immediately before the death of the deceased was being maintained either wholly or partly by the deceased. So someone who's financially dependent upon the deceased at
the time. It could be, because I've seen a case like this, a grandchild. It could be a grandchild who are living with their grandparents. Mm-hmm. The grandparent passes away. That grandchild can contest the will if they don't feel they've been provided for. And I think what springs to my mind when I say that, Stephanie, is say if the grandchild was raised by their grandparents, were living with them all their lives, the grandparent passes away, and then the grandchild doesn't get as much of the division of the pot as their uncles and aunts do, who are the deceased's direct children. Can they then turn around and say, well, it doesn't really come under reasonable financial provision because I've got a little bit, but I want an equal share because I was part of this person's life actually every day?
Yeah, so what the law doesn't do under the Inheritance Act is it doesn't consider fairness generally. It's not about equal.
Wow, that's a big, bold statement, isn't it? It's about
looking at the individual and seeing what they need for their maintenance, essentially, aside from when you're dealing with spouses and civil partners, because they're entitled to something more than maintenance. But when you're looking at the likes of grandchildren, you're looking at what do they need to live.
I guess I can understand that, because what I might deem as fair, somebody else may deem as unfair. So if the law is to step in and say, right, we're going to sit here and judge what's fair and unfair, then it can become a really big, complicated, spider-webby complex. Everyone arguing, well, that's not fair and that's not fair. And it can go on and on. Whereas if the law says, and it does, it's provision for what is required rather than what everybody or a single person may deem as being fair or unfair, then I guess the law can assist in trying to draw the line a little bit better.
Yeah, and it comes back to, again, that fundamental principle that we have in English law, which is that a testator can leave their assets as they wish. So it's the law not wanting, I think, to step into that too far. So it does so, I think, to the minimum that it needs to make sure that those who should be provided for are provided for.
So that's interesting, because if the, say, and I'm taking this grandparent and grandchild example, if the grandparent said, well, I'm going to leave everything to my grandchild, I'm going to cut out my own children. And I tell you, I've certainly heard that over the years a few times. The children, if they try to make a claim to the will, on the basis that they haven't been provided for in the will, could only make a claim on the basis that they have not been financially provided for and reasonable financial provision hasn't been made for them. They can't make a claim to the will on the basis that, well, why should it go to a grandchild when we are the next in line to the parent that's passed away?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's not necessarily about that. And that might be shocking to some people.
It's shocking to me now. Yeah. It's shocking to me as I say it, actually, because you think,
of unfairness. It's about, you know, making sure that people are provided for. So, for example, if the children are adult children, and presumably they are, if there are grandchildren set to inherit, but if they're adult children who have good paying jobs, who can keep their own home, who don't need the money, essentially, for their making, versus a grandchild who has been reliant on the deceased, then you can see that.
Even if they're an adult grandchild. But, you know, I can see that argument. I can see it all over the place. And I've certainly seen it in terms of, you know, in my law firm a few times. And I can see it even more, because it's not uncommon, actually, that parents fall out with their children. And it's not uncommon that sometimes parents have a better relationship with their grandchildren. So, it's all very interesting stuff. Okay, let's talk about time limitations, because I know that time limitations and the law can be incredibly sensitive. Is there a time limit to make a claim and dispute a will?
Yes, so under the Inheritance Act, you have to bring your claim within 6 months from the date on which either the executor has obtained the grant of probate, or where there is no valid will, 6 months from when the administrator has obtained the letters of administration. So it's quite a short time period. So, you know, it's something that you need to be thinking about very quickly.
I just want to say, Stephanie, that's if you want to make a claim for financial provision. There's a six-time limit, isn't there?
Yes.
So if you're making a claim to challenge the validity of the will, there is no time limit there, is there?
That's right, yes. It's a stark contrast, really, between these Inheritance Act claims, which is 6 months, and then, as you say, to actually contest the validity of a will, it is something different. So that's the sort of things we were talking about earlier. If you think, for example, there's been undue influence and the like,
and the will should be null and void, then you don't have a time limit. But it probably is, again, wise to say that you should jump onto anything that you think is incorrect, because if you're trying to claim the validity of the will and the probate has been granted, and the executor, and if there is a will, or the administrator, if there isn't a will, has dealt with all the assets, and you're challenging the validity and therefore trying to prevent those assets from being dispersed, you know, that's the whole point, isn't it? You want to try and make your claim prior to the assets being dispersed. But that is, it's very interesting that there's only a 6 months time limitation from the time that probate is issued. I mean, that doesn't seem like a long time at all.
No, and there is some discretion, of course, to allow claims to be made out of time. But it's very much the rule is 6 months, and you really would have to prove to the court why it is they should exercise that discretion to allow you to bring your claim out of time. And as you've said, realistically, the longer you wait, if assets have been distributed, it then becomes very difficult. And what you really want to do is get your claim in before the assets have been distributed.
Absolutely, because the whole point, isn't it, of saying this will was not valid is to try and stop the assets from being distributed in the way that they will be distributed. No. Stephanie, that's all we've got time for. I say, as I gasp, and thank the Lord that we didn't have another technical issue.
So thanks very much for having me, Hattie. It's been really nice.
Thank you, Stephanie. Thank you ever so much. And I know that we're going to have, and I said to you before we started recording the first time, that we could probably have part 50 to disputing a will and still be talking about it. So we'll definitely be doing that. But thank you ever so much for your time today.
Oh, you're welcome.
And what I'll say to our listeners is don't forget to click and subscribe to our podcasts. And you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn and YouTube by searching Get Legally Speaking. Also visit our website at getlegallyspeaking.com. Thank you for listening.